Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu. I'm filling in for Allison Stewart today. The tabloid paper, The National Enquirer, became a household name by going after celebrity news, political gossip, and even outright gore. Over the decades, the paper embraced its notoriety, leaning into conspiracy theories and half-truths in order to build a multi-million dollar media empire. And now, a new documentary chronicles the story of that rise and the ruthless tactics and limitless expense accounts that it took to get there. Scandalous, the untold story of the National Enquirer, will be out in theaters this Friday, November 15th. And joining me now in the studio to talk about it is the director, Mark Landsman. Mark, hi. Welcome to All of It.
Thank you, Shamita. Nice to be here. Thanks.
And you know, I thought we'd have some fun with this, Mark. I thought maybe we could invite some listeners to call in, join our conversation, if you ever had any ties to the National Enquirer. So did you work for the paper at any point in your career? It's possible. Were you a photographer or maybe a freelancer? Give us a call if you ever worked for the National Enquirer. We want to hear your stories. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Mark, let's start with just a little bit of history.
Sure.
Generoso Pope purchased the New York Evening Enquirer, which was an existing paper, in the 50s.
Yeah.
And his first big move was to rename it the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
What was Pope's vision for the paper in its early years?
Yeah, well, Generoso Pope Jr. was the son of one of the most powerful Italian Americans in New York City, Generoso Pope Sr., who had a company called Colonial Sand and Cement, which poured the foundation for Rockefeller Center and Radio City Music Hall. He also was the publisher of Il Progresso, which was the largest Italian American weekly in the country at that point. So as you can imagine, he was a very influential figure, not only in New York City, but nationwide. And when he died, his son, Generoso Pope Jr., was a black sheep of the family. He was sort of on the outs with the rest of his family, and he really was struggling to make a mark for himself. And in 1952, with a $75,000 loan from his godfather, who was Frank Costello of the Gambino crime family,
right?
He bought the New York Enquirer, which was a tiny little racing paper that had a circulation of under 20,000.
And that was a bit of a sticking point, right? Where the money came from to actually purchase the paper and its ties to crime families in New York.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a sticking point. It's just fact. It's just history. It's what happened. That paper never satisfied Gene Pope. He had very big ambitions. He had very big shoes to fill. He had something to prove. But the content of the New York Enquirer was just dull and wasn't doing it for him. And then, you know, the story goes that in the mid-50s, he's driving down one of the New York parkways and he comes across a horrific car crash. And there are mangled bodies and blood and broken glass strewn everywhere. But the thing that catches his attention is that there are hundreds of rubberneckers angling to get a view of the carnage. Mm. And he has this epiphany at that moment, oh, that's exactly what I should do with my paper. This is what people want to watch. And he shifts the content almost overnight to gore. So sort of Ouija-style crime photos, you know, spikes through the forehead, headlines like I ripped out her heart and stomped on it, really graphic, nasty stuff. And his circulation shot through the roof. He peaked at a million.
Now, another tactic that I guess he used was this idea of getting supermarkets to agree to carry the Enquirer, and especially right next to the checkout. So these two ideas, for me at least, were a little incongruous, right? The idea of like gore on the front page and then put them in the supermarkets where your kids are being pushed through the strollers and cashiers.
Totally incongruous. And
how was this a successful model? How did he manage to do it?
Well, he was a bit of a marketing genius, and he was very prescient. And he saw that the urban newsstand was going away. There was a large migration into the suburbs, and with it went the newsstand and the newsboy yelling extra, extra, read all about it. And he had to figure out a way to get eyeballs for his paper. Well, where were all the people at this time period in the supermarkets? And he thought, well, where in the supermarkets am I going to have a captive audience? And that's when he identified this piece of real estate at the front of every supermarket checkout counter in America. But a gore paper was not going to cut it. You're not going to have that competing with Cheerios and milk because it was disgusting. So, and neither did the heads of the supermarket, the largest supermarkets wouldn't even consider. I mean, he had a horrible reputation. So he decides that he's going to radically change his content, and he's going to embrace the kind of content that he thinks that the average American woman, he called her Missy Smith in Kansas City. He identified her, who was in the grocery store once, if not twice a week. What would she most want to read? What would she most want to talk about with her girlfriends in the beauty parlor, or come back home and tell her husband about? And he said he created this formula. It was celebrity gossip, miracle cures, fad diets, psychic phenomenon, and these human interest stories that he called gee whiz stories. He also called them Hey Martha stories, because as he would say, you know, the husband would be in his sort of Archie Bunker chair in the living room reading the National Enquirer, and he would read some story about an arthritis cure, and he would yell across the hall like, Hey Martha, did you hear?
Yeah, stories you want to turn and tell the people around you.
Stories you want to spread virally. It was social media, early social media.
Early social media, that's right. I'm speaking with the director, Mark Landsman. We're talking about his new documentary, Scandalous, The Untold Story of the National Enquirer. And I was amazed that you got so many former Enquirer employees, reporters and editors, to talk to you for this documentary. There must have been dozens of them in the film. How are you able to find so many willing participants? Because the Enquirer does have a bit of a checkered reputation.
That's saying it,
the least.
To say the least, yeah. You know, getting people to talk for this film was a very, there's sort of like a film behind the film with that. I mean, you know, you had people, the whole thing started actually where the story sort of found me. My wife's best friend's father was in town in California visiting, and we got invited to a dinner. And at that dinner, over several rounds of drinks, he kept regaling us with stories of his former career as a tabloid reporter at the earliest, during the earliest years of the National Enquirer, 73, 74. And he just went on and on about bribery, disguises, espionage, checkbook journalism, global travel. You know, if Liz Taylor was staying at the Ritz, you were staying at the Ritz. Mm. Just this whole, you know, ethically compromising universe that, you know, was really fascinating and sort of sounded like a great spy novel. And the more he talked, the more I said, yeah, this could be an incredible film. And we talked a little bit more. And all this was before Jeffrey Toobin's story in The New Yorker had broke in July of 2017. And so, you know, when that story broke about the alleged relationship between Pecker and Trump and sort of the papers getting behind the candidacy early on, mm-hmm. that's when I called this man back. His name is Malcolm Balfour. And I said, Malcolm, we should meet. And he said, well, I'm coming back to LA and I'm having some drinks with some old Enquirer buddies who live in that area. You should come out with us. And I did. And I just sat there gobsmacked because they just swapped stories from these trenches like war buddies. And they weren't holding back and they weren't particularly expressing any remorse. They were just kind of, it was like glory days. And I said, you know, this could be a great film. And that's where it got started.
Yeah, and that was something that did strike me, was just how brazenly some of the former staffers spoke about the tactics that they were encouraged to employ, like the get the story at all costs ethos that was really there. How did you, as the filmmaker, feel responsible for portraying their work?
I think, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, your responsibility is to get out of the way and allow the story to be told in the most authentic way possible. You know, unless you want to be making a piece of propaganda yourself, the idea is to step away from that and let people tell their firsthand accounts of what happened. And that was really our goal. You know, the fact of the matter is that there are really, the Enquirer is the main character in the film. And like any great character in a film, there's the origin story and then there's this trajectory that has all kinds of transformations in it, you know, before it leads to something else. And that's what happened. The Enquirer is like a Frankenstein story. You know, there was a mad scientist back in the 50s who created this formula, identified, you know, General Sopope had a background in psychological warfare. He was worked for the CIA. He had been an MIT engineer. He had this incredibly uncanny understanding of the American mind and what it craved. And so he did that. And the Enquirer's intention wasn't political in the beginning. It was escapist. It was like, okay, listen, you know, cities are burning around you. Your sons are off in Vietnam. Watergate is percolating all around you. Here's this form of escape that is going to sort of take you away. And, you know, that monster morphs over time in different hands until it arrives at a different mad fill in the blank. And we have the situation we're in now, mm-hmm. where the paper becomes a piece of blatant political propaganda. So that trajectory was fascinating. How do we tell that story of connecting the dots and asking a fundamental question? You know, how in the world did we get here? You know, to a place where, you know, the country can't even have a civil debate on what constitutes a fact. How did we get here? And what role did this publication have in that?
I am guessing that you tried to get current staffers and current leadership at the Inquirer's parent company, perhaps, on camera. Were they just outright not interested?
A futile effort. Yeah. No, we made very concerted efforts to extend an invitation to current AMI employees, to David Pecker, to Dylan Howard, and we were declined. We tried. We tried, mm-hmm. and we tried to get certain past employees, and we were met with, you know, a brick wall. Some people just said flat out, I can't violate my NDA. Others wouldn't return my calls, or, you know, just said, oh, this is a fantastic project. I would love to talk about it, but I just can't because I've got a book coming out, this, that, or the other thing. But what we were able to get were people who were really important seminal figures as this paper was being created and then as it transformed over time. And some of them were there under the Pecker era, mm. as well, which was great. So we were able to cover, you know, a large swath of time.
Were any of these people people who had signed NDAs and were choosing to speak?
Yes, there were a few. One of them, the late Jerry George, was the LA bureau chief for the Inquirer and had a nearly 30-year history there. And he was extremely forthcoming. And I said to him at some point in the interview, I said, Jerry, you know, aren't you afraid? Aren't you worried? And his response back to me was, you know, I'm a substitute teacher and I drive a cab. What are they going to do? Mm. What are they going to do? And he also felt like it was his duty to tell the truth about what happened. And I think we're seeing that more and more. I think we're seeing that in Ronan Farrow's book. I think we're seeing that in the reporting of Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey. I think we're seeing an incredible effort to just move away the veils, blow away the smoke, and get at what really happened.
Let's talk about some of those concepts you brought up, especially Ronan Farrow's book, the title of which is Catch and Kill. And that is a reference to a practice that was happening at the Inquirer. Can you talk a bit about the Inquirer's history of using its influence and using its literal money and its power to buy stories?
So, you know, every Inquirer employee, former employee that I talked to told me the same thing. We never heard of the term catch and kill until it entered the lexicon with the reporting in the New Yorker. It wasn't part of our jargon. They used to call it trade outs. And this was an old term from old Hollywood that was a practice that involved this sort of holy triumvirate of a celebrity, their publicist or lawyer, and the National Enquirer. Substitute the National Enquirer, by the way, for other gossip magazines, Rona Barrett, etc. But basically, this triumvirate worked it out. You have to remember that the Enquirer was a spy network at that time. They had moles everywhere. They knew your hairdresser. They knew the nurses at the hospital that checked you in. They knew your valet. They knew your chauffeur. They knew your agent, your manager. They knew your disgruntled brother-in-law. And all of them were on the payroll. You know, they spent thousands of dollars in source money. So they knew everything about you. And if there was a scandal, something scandalous happened, they would come to you and say, well, listen, we know that this is happening with you and the nanny or your client and the nanny. But instead of running that story, we would love an exclusive of you with your family over Christmas or a Thanksgiving with fill-in-the-blank celebrity. And then a trade-out would happen. That is very different than catch and kill. Catch and kill is we're going to approach the nanny because the nanny got nothing out of that trade-out. But catch and kill is the nanny has information that we want. We're going to approach the nanny. We're going to convince the nanny that we are a platform for her to tell her story and get it out there. A book deal, a movie deal, article, whatever it is. We're going to have her sign a document that basically signs her rights away to tell that story anywhere in the universe in perpetuity. And then we're going to take that document and we're going to bury it. That's catch and kill. And that was done at the behest of powerful people, men, to keep them squeaky clean. Mm-hmm. And that's radically different. And that practice horrifies the old guard at the Inquirer, because that just was not done, not in that kind of a way.
Right, so both of these practices were employed at different points.
They were, and you could say that the seeds of it, you know, the DNA of catch and kill was always in the, always there, but how it was used, what was caught and what was killed and for what reasons have changed over time. And now it's politically motivated.
Can you talk a bit more about what former Inquirer reporters and editors had to say about the past few revelations that have really come out more in the past few years, the way that the paper handled negative stories about President Trump, the way that similar tactics were used by Harvey Weinstein, and Ronan Farrow reported on this, with the paper's CCO at the time to discredit Weinstein's accusers. And in fact, just yesterday, the Daily Beast is reporting that the CCO, Howard, was planning to funnel money to accused rapist R. Kelly to produce a kind of a TV documentary series for the Inquirer's parent company. What did former staffers have to say about the current state of the Inquirer, the current reputation?
Well, yeah, I have to remember, Shmita, what's so extraordinary about working on a film about the Inquirer, where news is breaking literally every day, is that we had to make a decision. At a certain point, when you're making a film, a feature film nonetheless, you have to sort of say, we're not going to chase the news cycle. Because if we do, we'll never finish the film. And it's a futile gesture, because it just keeps unfolding and unfolding. So all of this stuff, even the revelations in Ronan's book, came after we had interviewed our people. Mm. Now, there were plenty of things that happened before and during the filming that we asked people about and are in the film. And I think that the sort of collective feeling about it from people was a sense of real melancholy. It's strange to talk about tabloid reporters and melancholy in the same sentence. It's weird, right? Because, I mean, listen, this, I'm not sympathizing here, okay? It's like the practices are not to be condoned. But there was a particular pride that they took in working for a publication that sort of just went after the rich and powerful, and, you know, they made meals out of it. But also, you know, a lot of those, you know, there were other attributes that they were proud of. Mm. There was no endorsement of a political candidate. The paper wasn't partisan back then. That really changed under the current regime in 1999 and onward. So the perspective in the film really looks at that. What was that climate change like? And it was a cold, bitter breeze that blew in when that change happened. And that's what was expressed in the film.
Are we meant to walk away from the documentary thinking, and I've seen it, I told you, right? Thinking that the Inquirer was a singular institution at a singular time in its history? Or is there a warning somewhere in here about the ways in which even the people involved in making the thing can find a way to justify some of its worst outcomes?
You know, it's a great question. And I think that, you know, I like to think about the Inquirer in some ways as like a metastasis happens, right? So the Inquirer is one part of a diseased system that just continues to spread and transform from first a paper publication into television, cable television shows like A Current Affair, Hard Copy, Entertainment Tonight, into the first iteration of internet tabloid journalism, into the next and the next, into the Twitterverse. So, you know, I think to point your finger at one publication is naive. You know, it's systemic. And it's a reflection of something that's within ourselves. I think, you know, people like Brooke Gladstone, Maggie Haberman have even said, you know, Americans are looking to sort of point the finger at who's the culprit. That's the culprit. They're to blame for why we're in this mess. No. I think it's really important for people to understand that just like the nutrition, that just like the food that we eat, and we're conscientious of what we put into our bodies, we also need to be conscientious about the media we consume and the sources. You know, are those sources reliable? Do they have a track record for fact-based journalism? Or are they just echo chambers that are reflecting back to us our beliefs and our comfort level? Mm. And I think, you know, hopefully the walk away from the film is, you know, look, we're all complicit. You know, whether you bought the Inquirer or not, you know, there is a complicity here. It's a participatory thing, media. It's not like this totally didactic situation. We're not, you know, so.
I think my colleague Brooke Gladstone also said, we get the media that we deserve.
She did.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. And this is where we are.
I've been speaking with Mark Landsman. He's the director of the new documentary, Scandalous, The Untold Story of the National Enquirer. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Shmita. Thank you so much.
Coming up, WNYC planning editor Kate Hines is going to stop by. We'll talk about what stories our reporters are covering this week, and we will be taking your calls about accessibility and transit. So get ready to call in.